We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Ben.
And tonight we are going to be looking at Blake 7, the Robert Holmes penned episode entitled Killer. I know it's going to be like it's all about serial killers and stuff. I know.
Because it's Killer.
Yeah, or this is before that. So if this is that before then that was Michael Jackson stole this. The Liberator goes to the planet Phosphoron, where Avon is calling in an old debt from an old friend named Tynus. He wants a new cipher crystal so that Blake and the Liberator can keep up on Federation communications. But Tynus is in a position of trust and doesn't necessarily think his life is worth giving up that crystal, but Avon convinces him it's either that or you go to jail for participating in the same computer fraud that I was part of and got captured for. Tynus reluctantly agrees. Meanwhile, a derelict spaceship from 700 years ago is found in the vicinity of Phosphoron, and Blake's curiosity gets the better of him as he follows along with the investigation in another part of the base on Phosphoron with Dr. Killjoy. No. Dr. Brierly. No. Dr.
Belfire.
Belfire, that's it. And it turns out that it contains a deadly alien virus intended possibly to wipe out all of mankind, or at least all of spacefaring mankind. Ooh, which one will turn out to be the killer in the end? I don't know. All right, so we've gotten all that heavy brooding,
all the angst
out of the way last week.
Yeah.
So now we're back to a sort of
standard, to the mission.
The mission. That's right. And on top of that, we have, I think this is the first Robert Holmes.
Yes, it is.
And story. So Robert Holmes, some of you will know as one of Doctor Who's greatest writers, and I say that without a touch of irony. He has turned in many of the most memorable episodes of Doctor Who. Trial of a Time Lord Part 11. but not Part 12, and I think that's therein lies the problem. Deadly Assassin. Carnival of Monsters. Let's see. He's always good for the double act. So that means Talons of Wen Chiang.
Yeah. Which some people can. I've heard that a lot of people consider that to be one of his finest.
Yeah. I mean, he's done a lot of really good stories over the years, and so we won't hold Trial of a Time Lord Part 11 against him, since he, or is it? Is Trial of a Time Lord 12 or 14?
I don't care to know.
It must be 14. So he did Part 13. The Ultimate Foe Part 1.
I don't care to know.
Sadly, Pip and Jane Baker finished it after he died.
Yeah.
Ooh.
So I will forgive him for that.
Yeah, we'll forgive him for dying on that one.
Yeah.
That is the only excuse for that one. Doctor Who Great comes to Blake 7. How does that work for you?
Well, in terms of what did I think about this episode, I've just got two words. Robert Holmes.
Boy, it is a Robert Holmes story.
Wow.
Yeah.
It just had wow written all over it. I will go on record and say that so far this is my favorite Blake 7 episode that I've seen. I just loved it.
I do enjoy this episode. This is a standout episode for me, although, and I've always felt that way, partially because I just think it's such a fascinating conceit. And I'm ignoring the Avon story pretty much completely here. I'm talking about the virus.
Yeah, me too, oddly enough. I mean, the Avon, there's some really good interplay between Avon and Villa, and that was one of Holmes's great strengths and the way he was able to write the dialogue and the scenes between the two of them, which was very enjoyable.
Well, he's big on the double act.
I mean, yeah.
He always has the, I mean, Glitz and Dibber even that was later stuff that was his too. And he just likes to have two guys that play against each other. In Carnival of Monsters, it's the two showmen. In Towns of Wen Chiang, it's Jago and Lightfoot.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, that's his thing. So he's applied that to Avon and Villa.
Right. But the part of the story that I found to be most interesting was, oddly enough, the storyline that Blake was in.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It was so strange. As I got to about the 26-minute mark, it became abundantly clear. Production values notwithstanding, because some of the production values are just really, really sad.
There is something I will say that this episode stands up to me is like the most silly costumes ever.
Oh, the Michelin Men?
No, I think the Michelin Men aren't nearly as bad as the fire response teams wearing the big circular disc over their back or whatever it is.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty pathetic. No, I got a big laugh out of the Michelin Men, and then I did some reading and found out that they actually rented – those were actual Michelin Men costumes
from the totally
Michelin Men company. Yeah, it's true. They actually borrowed it for the production, and it was very pathetic. But yeah, the costuming in this episode was really sorely bad.
And yet it was daring. I mean –
well, they took a chance.
They took a chance. They did something different. And
I mean, it's not Sylvia Anderson. I'll say that.
It doesn't make a lot of sense. But it
hey, they were trying something. It was different.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, why this particular base has to wear the silly clothes in plastic, I don't know, but
yeah.
High oxygen world or something.
But what I really loved about it, like I said, I got to about 26-minute mark, and I just really came to understand how much I was loving this episode. To me, it felt like I was watching something that felt like pure science fiction with a good touch of horror to it.
Mm-hmm.
The whole virus thing. I mean, it kind of is sort of a callback to maybe elements of The Thing,
mm-hmm.
the classic story, not necessarily the movie with James Garner
James Garner.
Sheriff Matt Dillon, that guy, that actor.
James Arness,
thank you.
I thought you were talking about Snake Plissken.
Oh, God, no. No,
really? You got him mixed up with James Garner?
No.
You were thinking, James Arness. Yeah.
James Arness, yes.
Robert Graves' brother.
Right. So you got these kind of throwbacks, and also you see how this kind of story idea, it's been around in science fiction and horror for some time now. I mean, we see it later in other shows. I mean, it even plays a little bit in Alien. There's a little hint on that as well. So there was a good horror element for 1976 television. I thought it was very, very well done. But it just felt like a pure science fiction film at the same time. And there was no personality angst to distract us. I mean, we got a little hint of it in some of the dialogue between Villa and Avon, especially when referring back to Blake at some point. But it didn't dominate the story, which was a very refreshing change.
I mean, let's face it. Gan was a relatively minor character, even though he was supposed to be bigger. And so, you know, you don't really need a whole lot of time grieving for him. So, one episode's enough.
Yeah.
And then we can just forget him because basically they'd forgot him all the time anyway. So, yeah.
Pretty much. And we don't miss him.
No.
We do not miss him at all in this. And everybody else, I thought, had a really good standout moment, even if they weren't on the planet. I mean, both Jenna and Callie had a couple of good moments on Liberator. So, I thought this was a very enjoyable episode. I mean, and even just some little touches, like when Blake introduces himself to Dr. Belfryer and his assistant, whatever that guy's name is, Igor, I don't know. Can't remember, and I don't care.
Gibney,
something like that. Yeah, love
Gimple,
Gamera. I'm not sure. The hair. I don't know.
Gimli. I don't know. The Patterson Gimli film.
Possibly. In any case, something that I found very enjoyable was Belfryer's reaction to Blake, and some people might find this to be just a simple, trivial, non-important issue, but I found it very enjoyable, where his own scientific curiosity completely overrode any social, political rubbish that exists within the Federation and in their attempts to get their hands on Blake.
Funny you should say that, because I didn't take it that way. I mean, I didn't take it that it was his scientific curiosity over this. I took it that this was a demonstrative proof that the Federation, Servalon's particular, fears that Blake is becoming a symbol or true. Here's a guy who basically probably agrees with Blake. He's a virologist. He's a brilliant scientist. He's out in the middle of nowhere. Why? We don't know why he's out there. And they even mention that. It's like, why the most brilliant virologist in the universe is out here on this godforsaken outpost in the middle of nowhere? And my guess is that he doesn't want to have much to do with
the Federation.
The Federation, or, you know, politics or anything like that. And Blake and his assistant, too. Both of them are just immediately willing to turn a blind eye to Blake. They know who he is. They immediately know who I am. They both put a knowing smile on their face. I think he was among friends.
Well, I do too. But in a
was just like, you know, wow, okay.
But in a way, you're kind of saying the same thing that I am too, just from a different angle. Because we've seen past episodes where there have been scientists that would just sell out the Liberator crew,
right?
And they were very, very loyal to the Federation without even batting an eye. And in this particular guy. Not so. I mean, science is what primarily drives him. Now, maybe he is a Blake sympathizer. Maybe he's just fascinated with the fact that Blake apparently has this advanced technology at his fingertips. I'm not entirely sure, but what was just so nice is that he didn't allow the Federation politics to color his own judgment in a negative sort of way, which allowed for a very good dynamic to take place between the two of them, even though it was not, you know, not going to last very long. It still made for a refreshing manner in which that story was told, as opposed to what we've had in the past. This was not a paint-by-the-numbers kind of story.
Well, here's the other thing, too. I mean, I have this more or less in my notes. Belfryer, the character, and the actor were a joy in this episode.
Oh, I agree. I loved the actor. I thought he was great.
But, I mean, the character he was playing, I mean, just the little nuances about being a little impatient with the pathologist, but at the same time seeing the humor of it. I mean, this was not a one-dimensional character at all. This was a pretty well, from what turned out to be a short-lived and basically transitory character, he was
a well-rounded, he was a very well-rounded, practically fully realized character.
And you would enjoy being around this guy. Thanks.
Yes, absolutely. Even if he showed any kind of impatience towards me because of something I'd done wrong, at least I know that he's not going to be one of these, as you said, a very two-dimensional guy who's going to take it personal or treat me in a really bad way. No, there was something very enjoyable about him. In fact,
it was good-natured.
You know, very, very good nature.
He's like prodding the guy, but he's talking about, like, this guy's, you know, like this. And it's like, yeah, okay, get going. Smile, smile, smirk, smirk, see what I told you, ha-ha. I mean, it was just like, wow, Robert Holmes really just nailed that, the dialogue and that character, and then the casting on it just cinched that one up.
Yeah. Did you know that that actor was originally pegged to play Barusa in Invasion of Time?
In the second appearance of Barusa.
The second appearance of Barusa, yes. He was they were looking at casting him in the part, and for whatever reason, he didn't take it. It would have been interesting to have seen him play the part.
Barusa. I've never been happy with any of the casting of any of the Barusas.
Really? I loved the second one.
Well, that's Invasion of Time.
Yeah. I loved him. I thought he was great.
He's probably my favorite of the bunch.
He's the least annoying.
There you go. He's the least annoying. But he's a little old and...
Well, he's got elderly whimsy. But be that as it may, I mean, this actor that we had playing Dr. Belfryer was looked at originally for it. You know, and for whatever reason, maybe it's best that he didn't get it, because maybe if he had, maybe he wouldn't have landed this role in Blake 7. Who's to say? In any case, he was a great joy. Now, somebody that was interesting is Tynus.
Yeah, yes.
He was kind of an interesting, you know, and he was bugging me to no end. I could not place him. And then I did a little research and then realized that's the actor Ron Lacey, who I think most people would recognize him as Major Arnold Tott, the Gestapo agent in Raiders of the Lost Ark.
Yeah, he's got that look.
It's him. It's him, and I would not have recognized him. There's just something in the speech pattern that's what clued me in. I thought there's something very familiar about this guy. There's something in the way that he speaks that kept telling me I should know who this man is. And so I did some digging, and oh, Ron Lacey. I had no idea. It was kind of interesting to hear him speak in his natural British accent instead of trying to put on a bad German one.
Okay,
but he was interesting as sort of a heavy. I mean, I think he almost falls into the cliche of the Federation loyalist. I mean, despite the history that he and Avon.
Do you think he's really a Federation loyalist, or do you think he's a Tynus survivalist? Or he's just,
well, I think he's an opportunist.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't think.
I don't think it's so much that he's a Federation loyalist. In fact, I think there are very, very few Federation loyalists. I think once you're in the Federation, if you want to make a career out of it, it's all about who do I have to stab or who I have to step on the way up.
Okay. So if Avon had turned up on the planet and said, hey, I just stopped by to say hi and pay you back the $20 I owed you and left, would Tynus have turned him in? See, I feel like Tynus got pushed into a corner.
I think you're right, only because of the demand for that that crystal.
And
is
so
what
he started that whole. You know, first off, I have to kill Avon because he's got information on me. And second off, if I can turn in the ship and everything, I get to be a hero. I kind of felt like there might have been just enough. "Quote unquote friendship those two of them that he might have let him go if he hadn't basically come down and threatened him with.
It's
exposure.
Possible. It is very possible. Hard to say. I'd like to think that he would have honored his friendship, his past with Avon, but I don't know.
No which honor makes, amongst which makes
him,
thieves.
Yeah, exactly. Which makes him an interesting character to begin with at that point. Because now you have to keep second guessing him. What's he going to do? Although his motives did kind of become somewhat clear when he clandestinely sent a message back to Federation.
Yeah. So let's talk about the A story, even though I think the A story is the B story. But
I agree.
I'm not entirely. I assume killer refers to the virus.
That's my thought.
That's my thought too. But okay. So Avon and Villa have come down to the planet to coerce Tynus. Tynus is a confederate of Avon from the crime that got Avon put away. So this is, I think, the first time we've ever heard that there was anyone else involved in the crime that Avon was arrested for.
Agreed.
So I'm guessing that now we're going to start finding out that there's like hundreds of other Confederates that he had going on that he can now, you know, tie into. Call in favors and stuff.
It's possible. I'm not sure how I feel about that. It could make for a very colorful, interesting background expose on Avon.
As Villa said, I always knew Avon. I always said Avon has a friend somewhere in the galaxy.
Yeah, exactly. So, and I'm sure that Avon does, especially if there's
he's such a likable guy.
Well, you know, in a very weird way he is. But if there's something kind of mutually beneficial out of that, of course he would have some friends that are out there, you know, as long as
well, there's Blake. Blake is his besties.
Whether Avon would like to admit it or not.
So we had a comment on the website, and again,
I saw that.
Once again embarrassed to say I don't remember who it was that made the comment, and I don't have it in front of me. But they were trying. They were
like
discussing
Lord Iguana or something like that.
Mr. Iguana, and it could have been.
I think it was Mr. Iguana
about trying to explain away why Orak couldn't figure out central control.
Oh God,
we were talking about, and I. You know, I mean, we had that discussion at some great length. And the piece that was put forward as one way of trying to make that fit in the universe is that maybe he can't do it because they no longer have the Cypher crystal, which they lost a while back. And here they are trying to get another Cypher crystal. Coincidence?
No.
Yeah, I think that's...
I don't buy it for one reason, and that's in this very episode.
Right. He goes right into Central
Control. He goes right into Central Control so he can get a complete database on these old freighters.
Right.
So he can get into...
No, I know. It doesn't fit with Warak, and I just...
No.
I'm throwing it out there since the idea was postulated, and it's not to mock the idea or anything else, because, I mean, let's face it, it's just a horrible, horrible continuity gaffe on the part of sloppy writing.
I mean, I'll give him credit for trying to come up with some sort of retroactive...
That's as good as you can get. I mean, it does make sense. If they encrypted their communication and it's impossible to break the communication encryption, then okay, you wouldn't be able to do it. But I think the system that we have been explained for ORAC is that it can tap into the terial cells that make up the computer itself. So it's not intercepting the communications traffic. It's actually tapping directly into the physical other
It's hacking in.
Through its subspace carrier beams or whatever they call them that allow the moon disk creature to kind of burst forth. Is that
exactly? It's hacking into the system.
Right.
In a sense.
So it's not
It's not just tapping, no.
But anyhow, it's like a...
I mean, I'll give him credit for trying to retcon something there, but I'm sorry. I can't accept it.
It's just wrong.
It's just bad writing.
Bad writing. Or lazy. I'll put it lazy.
Yeah, lazy writing. And of course, you know, I'm sure you laughed when you saw it. I certainly did when Blake gave the order to ORAC. You know, tap into Central Control
tap?
And give me What's this. And I'm like, what tap? What is tap?
You must be more specific. Yeah. So this storyline is not much. You know, it's like, well, we have to get the crystal. Well, how do we get the crystal? If you take the crystal, then they'll change the cipher. So we have to get the replacement crystal, but you can't get the replacement crystal because the security guards have it. So what you have to do is you have to fake a fault in the first crystal, then take... get them to replace the crystal, and then you can take the faulty one, even though it's not really faulty. And, like, they wouldn't have security take the faulty crystal back and destroy it.
It was a poor man's Mission Impossible.
Yeah. But...
And thereby very, very uninteresting.
Set up an explosion, people run out, flapping in their funny white outfits, and then... Avon goes in and sets the fault. It's really not much. It really isn't much. But what it does do is it kind of... I think this is the first episode that sort of cements Avon and Villa as a team.
Yeah, because I know we're going to see a lot of them paired up in the future.
Yeah, I mean, that is actually largely considered the big team in Lake 7 without...
Well, they have...
But, you know, they have a...
They have a great chemistry.
Symbiotic relationship there. Villa is capable. He has a skill, and Avon has skills. Avon recognizes Villa's skills, and he uses him, and Villa recognizes Avon's skills, which are staying alive.
Right. And neither of them are exactly what you call idealists.
Correct.
Like Blake is.
Right. They're pragmatists.
Exactly. So it allows for them to better integrate with each other in terms of character development and, you know, sharing time on the screen. It makes it far more enjoyable to watch those two because, I mean, Blake is not very good with comeback lines that are memorable. Avon is very good at it, and despite the fact that Villa drives me crazy sometimes, he too, because of his personality – there are just some lines that he would just throw out there, which you'd never hear anybody else on the Liberator say. But Villa can say it, and it just feeds Avon, who then responds in kind, and it just goes back and forth, which makes for fun dialogue.
So to me, the moment in this episode, in that half of the episode, in the A story, the moment that goes above and beyond this episode is... Avon is making some disparaging remark about Blake's heroics because he's got something to do with the salvaging of the ship. And, you know, Avon makes a comment that his heroics are going to get us killed. And prior to that, Avon's been explaining that this task that he's got to do, he's got to get around 10,000 volts in his hand, and if he makes a mistake, he's fried. And Villa calls him on it. He calls him on it right there and then. And he says, and like putting your hand in 10,000 volts, you know, it's like you're basically, and Avon is doing heroics here. He is taking on a dangerous task for the cause, if you will, the cause of Blake's thing. And Avon rounds on it and says, the difference is I'm doing this for self-preservation. Blake is doing it for others. And Villa just sort of smiles. There is that sort of, yeah, I understand you really well.
Mm-hmm.
And this is, like I said, this is this cementing of these two getting that rapport down. And I think that one has more lasting effects than having that cipher crystal ever did. But isn't that deflector screen shield, the blind, as Blake calls it, this one, isn't that handy?
Mm-hmm.
Being able to sit in the orbit and nobody know you're there.
Oh, yeah, quite convenient. Oh, they have a cloaking device of sorts.
Well, Avon built it in the last episode.
Yeah, I remember that. I do remember him making it, but yeah, it's extraordinarily convenient.
Ah, but you know what I do like about that? It's here. He made it in the last episode.
And we still have it.
That's right, and we still
have
it.
And we can still use it.
Because they've made an upgrade to the Liberator, and we get to keep the upgrade. It's not like the transporter where you turn it into something where you can beam something into space as the ultimate weapon, and then next week, can't do that anymore.
Or Orak.
Or Orak, yeah, there you go. So
I'm sorry, I'm going to harp on that till hell freezes over.
I can see a small problem with that, and I'll try to remember to mention that when we get to Gambit, and
mm-hmm.
we'll, without being spoilery. But if anybody wants to write that down, there's going to be a small problem with Orak when we get to Gambit, and then you can see what we anyway. That's only a couple episodes away, I think.
It's not far.
It's not far down. So that's pretty much it. They get the crystal. Tynus gets killed. Blah, blah, blah. They escape.
And they actually get to do sort of what Villa originally suggested, and that was, why don't we just take it?
Oh, yeah, except there's just one problem with that. What happened last time? This exact plan. Their plan was to get one so nobody would know it was gone by, you know, flipping her out with a stolen crystal and then the backup crystal and the whole nine yards. And that didn't work out. So Avon's fallback plan was, we'll take the crystal, plant an explosive, and destroy it completely so they'll never know the crystal's missing.
Right.
Does that remind you of, seek, locate, destroy?
Yeah, a little
when they
too
got
familiar.
Their last crystal and they took it out and they planted the explosives and they blew it up with the intent of thing, and that didn't work either. So,
hey, if at first you don't succeed,
try again.
Yeah,
that part I was a little disappointed that, you know, Villa didn't say something. Like, well, it didn't work very well on, I can't remember what that particular planet was.
I know,
Kentaro.
But
Kentaro. Yeah. I can't believe I remembered that. Wow. That is a bit of gray matter that will be forever locked up for something useless.
Yeah. But in this case, it works out really well. I mean, even Avon is finally able to justify it. Oh, we can say the fire that was started helped to destroy the control room. Of course, really, the impetus behind that was him killing Tynus. Because I don't think Avon would have gone through with that kind of act if it had not come to blows between him and Tynus.
Well, he did place a bomb.
Yeah.
There was a bomb in there, too. So Tynus stuck his hand in there and fried, and then they detonated the bomb, too. So, but Tynus was dead by that point.
Yeah, but that's true. So, they should have gone with Villa's original suggestion in the first place, then.
Yeah, I mean, well, if they could have gotten in there.
I mean, as Tynus said, I mean, once you start the fire,
right?
There you go. And it's more than just Avon trying to rig it so it looks like that there's a fault in the crystal. I mean, to be honest, I think the idea of stealing the crystal and blowing the whole thing up is far more time effective?
He would have had to have killed, well, no, because then he'd had the blackmail on Tynus. That's a good question. I don't know. Could we have guaranteed that Tynus would have kept his secret? I don't know. Anyway, well, the practical upstart is they got the crystal and Aven lost a friend.
Yeah, in more ways than one.
Yeah, exactly. In more ways than one. He'll probably never forgive him. So, okay, now, the virus, the killer, the... And you already said this. It's a good mystery.
Well, I'm glad you used the word mystery, because there is a hint of a, more than a hint of a mystery, that I kind of wonder if the series is ever going to revisit.
Oh, the Darkling Zone, or yeah, uh-huh. In the future. Yeah, well, we'll have to find out whether we get back to the Darkling Zone. I didn't mean it that way. In other words, I meant the mystery of like what's happening. Not so much the whodunit, but
the virus. What's going on? Yeah,
and also, you know, there is the how can this? We're presented with a series of basically impossible things. You're presented with a 700-year-old ship that's 3,000 subluminal ship that's 3,000 light years from Earth, which is an interesting thing to note. We now know that the Federation expands at least 3,000 light years from Earth.
Yeah,
so. We could start working out how big the Federation is now.
Which has been something of a difficult task in the past because we have no concept on what their speed factors are.
No.
I mean, standard by 10, standard by 12.
It's like the London was months to get to Cygnus Alpha, but the Liberator can do it in minutes.
Yeah, and Cygnus Alpha, obviously, I mean, for... interplanetary travel like that, even months, it's still got to be traveling at faster than light speed.
You would assume, yes. You would assume that has to be the case. So,
and from everything that we've understood, the Liberator is up to this point the fastest ship the Federation has ever encountered.
Yes. So, but we have the ship. We have the one dead body on board the ship. We have the fact that the body comes to life in, and again, speculating, maybe this is not true, but I think the story is written in such a way that you're supposed to say, yep, Blake's right here. It came to life to kill the doctor just to force people to break quarantine.
Yeah. I mean, when Callie gets that sense of malevolence, that tells me that it's not just some mindless virus. There is a will. Of sorts, mm-hmm. That is in operation here. And even if it's on a primitive level, it is still there. And it is, as you said, it is to break quarantine.
So once it breaks quarantine, then we don't have to worry about it because the virus is spreading.
It's going to spread, and it's all about survival and reproduction, basically.
I thought the idea of the, what is it, the Terran ague? Is that what they called it?
I don't recall.
It was ague, but I can't remember what the
I didn't write
first
that down.
Word was. But it's apparently everyone who goes into space gets the 3-day sweats.
Right.
And it's a change to the molecular level. And this virus only targets cells in humans that have had that...
that syndrome or whatever you want to call it.
Everyone gets when they go into space. So as long as you've never been in space...
You're immune.
You're immune. So it's not meant to wipe out mankind, but it is meant to keep him...
isolated on Earth. It's meant to quarantine.
Yeah.
I find it also convenient.
I
also find it very convenient that apparently we didn't see any indication of... Well, obviously Blake teleported up to the ship pretty early. Mm. So he was probably free from any kind of contamination. But we're very lucky that apparently neither Avon nor Villa contracted it.
Villa is very close there at one point when he
went
out to go to the room and there was the guy crawling along the blisters 8, 12 feet away from him.
Yeah.
So, yeah, that was...
I mean, we can only assume that maybe they were able to whip up some kind of antidote.
No, I don't think that's the case. I think they just...
I don't either.
I think they just got lucky.
But that kind of stretches credibility a little too far for the sake of the story, especially when it's just running rampant. I mean, we've seen the incubation period in this, as far as this virus goes. They're saying people are coming down with it in minutes, and then just 12 minutes later, they're dead.
Mm-hmm.
So this thing is very, very contagious, fatal virtually instantly,
mm-hmm.
and yet Villa doesn't seem to catch it. I think that's very...
Well, it's air spread, so, he's 12 feet away. I think it's possible. The guy that was scooting away from him was the guy who bumped into Ghibli.
Ghibli.
Giblets, whatever his name was, just before he caught the disease. Mm. He was running out and saying, "I'm getting out of here." It's like, "Oh, you fool, you got to go to the thing." And then he ran away, and then Ghibli went and talked to the boss man and then forgot what he wanted and then died. And then that guy went off and he was broke quarantine and he's crawling and dying through the corridors in front of Villa. So, no physical contact. And if the air hadn't followed, I'm going to say it's a little bit worrying, and I think they probably could have staged it in such a way that I would have felt a little better, but I'm going to give him a pass. I think Belfriars came down last because it just hadn't gotten into his lab through air circulation yet by the time Mike had left. And Avon and Villa were, for the most part, in rooms where there weren't people.
True.
Except for that one scene where, the guy's scooching down the hallway and he gets knocked out and thrown down anyway. So, I'm going to...
Yeah, I can give it a pass, but only barely.
I absolutely... remember the first time I saw this episode, and I adored the Belfriars starting to write, say, "Here, write down this antidote," and Blake cuts him off and says, "So what you're saying is that the only people who've been in space get that?" "Yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's designed to keep people down on the planet and stuff." "Okay, all right, now go ahead and give me that formula."
I forgot
how to read.
Thank you, Blake.
I know. It's like, here's one thing I did like. I mean, I love that. I actually love that. I thought that's clever. They've set this up so that you lose your memory, and we've seen people do it kind of in different ways. So here's one. It's like, "I've forgotten how to read," and then he's dead.
I don't recognize these lines. What are they? Are they letters? I don't know. What's a letter?
Yeah. I like that. But what I thought was interesting is that, he says, "Now you need to get this down." And Blake tells Jenna, and Jenna starts recording it.
Right.
Not writing it down.
No, she's just recording the transmission.
She's recording the transmission. Okay. Which I'm going to say is decidedly high tech, considering that just a few minutes earlier, Blake says, "Hey, let me look at your star charts." And he pulls out a Velo-bound notebook with star charts in it. Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember that.
It's like, "Here."
Because he wants to show exactly where that Darkling Zone is.
"Here, I'll just point to the circle." Is it there? Oh, yeah, okay.
Well, they're primarily not into space travel anyway, except for maybe reconnaissance or like they were doing here. They were taking possession of the freighter. But they're not – their sole business is not space travel per se. So – they don't necessarily have to have up-to-date star charts.
I mean, it's really the kind of poorly forward-thinking that says this isn't computer data for starters, instead of a notebook.
I don't know.
Why would a virologist have a notebook sitting on his lab table with star charts in it?
Well, that's a good point. Why would he have it? But then I could also at the same time hear Servalin say, "Why would you need a computer that would have star charts on it anyway? Here's a book."
Yeah, so it was just one of those things. Let me borrow your star chart. Let me borrow your globe.
Let me borrow your
galaxy.
Binder.
Yeah. So that might have been a little...
But it makes for a good storytell at the same time. It's a very nice visual aid without having to rely on a special effect.
Kill a little time, yeah.
Yeah. So, hand wave, I'll let it go.
Let's see, what else have we got about it? I mean,
there's not much else.
There really isn't. It's just really sort of the mystery of trying to figure out You know, I liked the scenes, even though you could accuse them of killing time. I liked the scenes where they were on the Wanderer class ship, and we really don't see anything. It's more of audio theater.
Yeah, it's
that's a nice budget saving technique. Well, but at the same time, it worked.
It is a very good technique for building suspense. I mean, it's like classic Hitchcock. And this is where the good horror element comes in. And I kind of wonder if this isn't maybe what Holmes had in mind when he wrote it. I mean, it's very possible he may have thought, you know, let's have this be off screen and have it be audio only just to help build the suspense and start to sow the seeds of maybe even a little bit of terror. Because now there's this, you know, the potential threat. We don't know what the heck is going on. You know, all we hear are the reactions of the people. I mean, that is a very good cinematic effect whereby you can make your viewer very uncomfortable. Mission accomplished.
Yeah. Yeah. So,
But you're right. I mean, it serves a second purpose too, and that is it saves money. You don't have to buy a second. You don't have to construct another set.
Yeah. Then they showed one sort of darkened picture of a console that could have been, you know, used a million times before.
Oh,
Doctor Who.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it could have been used in that very episode for all we know.
And then the face.
Yeah.
You know.
I mean, that's a piece of cake. It's all a close-up. That's
right.
Nothing.
There was really nothing going on behind there. Speaking of saving money, the shuttle that took off or landed to
cover, stock footage.
Not just stock footage.
But that's like NASA's shot or something.
Oh, not that one. I wasn't talking about that one. When Blake is caught in the
exhaust tube. When it's landing.
When it's landing. That's the London.
I was going to say that. Yeah, it was the London. That's landing on Cygnus Alpha.
Which is also the shuttle from The Invisible Enemy.
Really?
That's the shot of the landing on Titan base.
Oh, God. I've only seen The Invisible Enemy once, and so that's why I don't remember.
Yeah, the London. Yeah, it's the same ship. And I don't know who made that first, whether it's the Invisible Enemy ship became the London, or the London became the Invisible Enemy. I think the London became the Invisible Enemy ship.
Most likely.
And the reason I say that is because in the second-to-last shot of the Liberator in this episode, the last shot is the drawing as they fly away, mm-hmm. but the second-to-last shot is where the Liberator is pivoting to turn and get out of there.
Right.
Go back and look at it again.
Oh, there's something there.
It's the London.
Yeah.
It's the scene from the pilot or the
right.
second episode
I saw
where
it too.
Had a docking tube and it's rotating with a ship.
I saw it and I'm like, okay, that's not supposed to be there.
Yeah, it's...
Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. So, it's like, well, it's a shame they don't have a model shot that doesn't have the London stuck to it because it would have been a nice shot.
It would have been a great shot. I'm sure if they were to remake the show today, then yeah, it'd be a piece of cake. The CGI, but
oh no, let's not remake.
No, ixnay on the CGI. Yeah, it is.
I will have probably a long discussion somewhere, partway through series 3 about remakes of Blake 7.
Indeed.
Indeed. That will be about the time that I'm going to start, that I think I can safely have my rant. but not yet. Not now.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, we'll save that. Pencil it in.
Very good. Write that one down. What else? About Harvest of Kairos. That would be a good time, I think.
All right.
Because...
Marking that one down.
Yeah. Yeah, that one's... Series 3's version of the web. In fact, it has web in it, come to think of it. I think it's the same web. All right, never mind.
Well, as you said, I mean, it's if they can recirculate footage, you know, to save money, then hey. I mean, this even though this was the theater department, it's still the BBC.
Yeah. I don't know that I have anything else on this episode.
I don't have much else on it either, except that, again.
Oh, I do.
What do you have?
Oh, I do. There is a line in this episode that just absolutely boggled my mind, and I even wrote it down, or I wrote a close approximation of it down. So, Blake says to Avon, or Blake says to Jenna, let's drop some quarantine buoys, plague warning buoys around the planet. No one can go to that planet until this thing burns itself out. And Avon, you know, you can't mean it, Blake. Servalon goes there, she catches the virus, our problem is solved. Thinking, of course, or you could have just killed her any of the opportunities you had to kill her.
No, that's kidding. What's
but that's not what I'm getting at. And then Blake says, if just one person gets off that rock
And survives,
it could kill millions. That is the one responsibility I will not take. That's the one. The one that I won't take. I might kill millions of people. I won't take
I won't take that one.
I won't take that one. Thousands?
Maybe. I'll think about it.
Yeah, no, but millions, that's one.
No, that's too far. That's crossing the line.
Billions? Yeah, I could do billions. I don't know, but not millions. It's like, it was such an oddly phrased line. I'm like, okay, that's a stumble on either that or Gareth Thomas read the line wrong. You know, instead of one small step for a man, he was supposed to say that is one responsibility I won't take, as opposed to the one. He may have just flubbed the line.
Yeah,
he couldn't do a retake.
It was funny. I did hear it, and it did set off an alarm in my head, and I thought, well, that is the strangest thing I've ever heard. But at the same time, I sort of understood what I believed he meant to say, and at that point, I just went on. But yes, you're right. That was a very, very peculiar line.
Okay. Now I'm done.
And I am too.
Oh, okay.
Because I
interrupted again, you.
No, I was going to say, I really don't have much anything else on that, except just to echo what you and I said, that this is an extraordinarily strong episode, especially after some of the real tossers that we've had for the last couple of weeks.
Did you just call them tossers?
Yes, I did.
Okay. Just check it off.
Yeah, well, I said it.
Yeah. All right. Yeah, I don't think I have to bleep that.
No, there's some double entendre in there, I'm sure. I mean, you could just throw those episodes away. That's what it means. Yeah, that's it. Sure.
So we'll just throw that off. Yeah. And we'll just toss it aside.
Yeah, toss it aside. That's it. Yeah, sure.
Well, and on that note, I suppose we've come to the climax of the episode, which is the ending.
Ta-da!
Ta-da! There you go. Hope it was good for you.
Need a cigarette?
No. No. All right. Well, when we come back for the next episode of Blake 7, it will be... I don't know, actually.
Neither do I. I don't have my list of stuff.
Hostage.
Oh, gee.
So,
I can only imagine.
Yes. You can only imagine who the hostage might be. All right, anyway.
Oh, God. Right. I have a bad feeling that Travis is in on this one.
I'm not saying anything. That would be a spoiler. Mm-hmm. And, Ben, thank you for joining me.
It was a joy.
And, listeners, thank you for joining us. And I've done that in the wrong order, so good night.
Cheers?
Exactly. Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us, leave us a review on iTunes. Or stop by and visit at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Find us on Facebook or Twitter. Search for Fusion Patrol. Or just drop us a note at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.